taking place to prepare the way for the Islamic Mahdi, their counterfeit Messiah, to come and rule the earth. Another report that I've received, this actually is an article from the Atlantic magazine, The Point of No Return. The Point of No Return. And it is the conviction of the writers of this magazine article that the world and the United States and Israel are at the point of no return with regard to Iran. It is a huge challenge for the Obama administration, writes the Atlantic magazine. And if things remain on the current course, an Israeli airstrike will unfold perhaps within the next 12 months. One day next spring, the Israeli National Security Advisor and the Israeli Defense Minister will simultaneously telephone their counterparts at the White House and the Pentagon to inform them that Benjamin Netanyahu has just ordered roughly 100 of their jets and other aircraft to fly toward Iran to destroy their nuclear sites. Fascinating times, very threatening times. Aren't you glad that we have a God that we can trust in? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not into your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your path, even in the midst of these trying times. Thanks for joining us. Get a copy of the book, The 10 Things You Need to Know About Islam, your gift of $11 or more to Save America Ministries. Get it on our website, saveus.org.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, hopefully for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jerry Cope, who is sort of an investigative reporter. He actually went down to the Gulf to actually check out what was really going on down there. And we've heard so many stories about what's really happened down there. And night after night after night, we would see the pictures on the video screen of the oil streaming up from the floor of the Gulf down a mile. And then we heard all sorts of conflicting stories. It was certain stories suggested that, initially, why all they had to do was simply to accept the offer of other countries. They had equipment there. They could have skimmed the oil off the top of the surface of the Gulf and cleaned it up. But, oh, we couldn't do that. We'd be violating some sort of a law to have other companies or other countries providing help for us. And so instead of that, they were spraying this very, very toxic substance named the Core Exit and dispersing the oil. And we were told that, suddenly there were 50,000 barrels of oil coming out a day, and then 100,000 barrels, and then we just don't know. We got so many conflicting stories, and then of course they just couldn't get this capped. And then about 99 days into the end of the tragedy, suddenly they're able to put a cap on it. And the question is, if you could do it in 99 days, why couldn't you do it at the first day? Or maybe the second or third day after they actually sawed the pipe off? Why did they wait all this period of time? Why did they focus our attention on what was going on down there? Why did they spray this dispersant, Sydney, which is a very toxic dispersant? And we've heard that the EPA told them they shouldn't use this, and then pressure was put on the EPA, and the EPA said it was all right to use. I mean, it's too toxic to use any other place in the world, but it's all right to put down there in the Gulf. And there are just so many questions. where does the truth lie? Well, all we know is what we hear on the radio, what we read in the newspapers, what we see on television. But are we getting the truth? Well, Jerry wanted to find that out, and so Jerry went down there, and he's going to tell you an amazing story. Jerry, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Are you feeling any better? Last time we talked, you had an awful cough.
Well, I think the answer to that is yes, I'm feeling better. I still have respiratory problems, but since I got back to the clean air in Colorado, it's quite a bit better than it was while I was down on the coast, where the air is far from healthy.
And apparently, a lot of people down there were having respiratory problems, weren't they?
Oh, they still are. There's some people have even had to be put into intensive care. It seems to depend mainly on the how long and how close you are to the oil and the dispersant. The worst stories I've heard, the people I've talked to that definitely were in the worst shape as far as physical symptoms directly related to being exposed to that stuff, are the cleanup workers who were out on the water, especially the ones that were out near the source, the Canyon 252 site. Those guys, some of them are seriously, seriously ill. Just the other day, well, it's actually a week ago today, a doctor in Boston, Kathy Burns, called me, and she had just been contacted by a captain who was hemorrhaging blood internally. And he finally, you know, it turned out that he couldn't see. Here's a good example.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. But ladies and gentlemen, the people out there all working on the site weren't allowed to wear respirators. I wonder why. Jerry, you go right ahead.
This particular boat captain, he was contacted his regular physician and went to his regular clinic, and they refused to see him because they had signed an agreement with BP not to treat anyone regarding health impacts from any kind of work that they were doing for British Petroleum or subcontractors. So his regular doctor had actually been paid and signed an agreement not to see him. So it took several days to find a doctor that finally would see him, and he wound up going over to Pensacola, Florida to see someone there. In fact, that was where they did some, they drew a ridiculous amount of blood from me to do a battery of tests that I believe the results we should get back Tuesday or Wednesday from those. But it looks like we're also getting next week back a lot of tests on water that was done inland, not on the coast, but actually several miles in on some different lakes and ponds. And preliminary indications are that the results are going to be exactly what we're looking for. And without jumping the gun here, I will tell you that part of the issue has been 2-deoxyethanol, which is a very carcinogenic compound. It's a volatile organic that is part of Corexit 9527, which was used in Exxon Valdez and caused serious health issues up there. And theoretically, at least according to statements by BP and the Coast Guard, it was not being used in the Gulf. They were using another form of Corexit, which is 9500, and there's been a lot of indications that that was not true, that they were actually using significantly more toxic solvents. These are basically industrial solvents is what they are, but we've had a lot of issues that didn't jive with Corexit 9500, so there's been a lot of testing done, and the first results of those are coming in early next week, and we are expecting to see confirmation that they have, in fact, been using 9527, which they said, number one, they were not, and the EPA would have never signed on to, and it's going to open up, I think, open up some serious litigation for the people that have been really sick, because the long-term effects of that I mean, just for example, Exxon Valdez.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Jeff, with Jerry. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Cope, and we're talking about his trip down there to the Gulf. Basically, apparently, there are several types of this core exit, and they insist that they used a very non-toxic type, certainly the type that they'd used up on the Valdez. They'd used the same product up there. What happened to the people who worked on the Valdez oil cleanup? Do you know, Jerry?
Well, I think the bottom line is, very few, if any, lived past the age of 51. They all died very early from a lot of different issues. Obviously, these heavy metals in the VOCs are carcinogens, and they're terrible for any kind of biological life. And to expose humans to it is unconscionable. And that this was done with the Coast Guard was instrumental in dispersing this stuff all over the Gulf of Mexico, and that the federal government played a key role in exposing millions and millions of people along the coast to basically one of the largest experiments ever conducted on a civilian population. It's criminal is what it is.
Well, why did they do that? I mean, certainly if the oil had come up, it had gone to the surface, it could have been scooped up, it could have been burned. Apparently a lot of it was burned, although we weren't told that. They didn't allow pictures of it, but because of that, or as to air pollution. But, of course, apparently a lot of it was burned, a lot of it was scooped up. Why did they want to use the dispersant? Because that just simply breaks this up and allows it to get around all these barriers they were putting in offshore and let it come right into the shore with it, not only the emulsified oil, because these are emulsifiers, but also with this toxic substance in it, this core exit. So why did they use it at all? What was the advantage of using this dispersant?
Well, it basically boils down to out of sight, out of mind. The only real reason to use the dispersant is so that it looks nicer from the air and you can't see the oil. It puts it under the water and it breaks it down. And the other thing that I failed to mention earlier in terms of the worst forms of corrosion, none of them are good, but the 9527 is that it has been shown to bioaccumulate. So once it's introduced into the marine ecosystem, then it will accumulate as it works its way up the food chain, which is the worst possible scenario. Basically, the reason they wanted to use it, the reason they did use it, is it makes it look nice from the air. It breaks it down, so when it comes in on the beaches, it's not as apparent. And it's basically been one big dog and pony show since immediately after the spill began.
Well, my understanding was the Environmental Protection Agency said you can't use this, it's far too toxic. And then, of course, then they said, it's all right to go ahead and use it. And, you know, so obviously somebody with a lot of money had put a lot of pressure, you know, on the EPA, and then they just knuckled under, irrespective of the health risk to not only the general population, but specifically to the people who are out there working on the various oil rigs, and especially those that were trying to control the this well.
Well, I don't think, the federal government since day one has allowed BP to dictate the response, and they've just gone along. I think the EPA's initial reaction was the correct one, which is they said you can't use this, this is not acceptable. Then, I think it's pretty clear that Lisa Jackson, the administrator of the EPA, received her marching orders from people above her, and that she was instructed that they were going to allow this to go on. And the Coast Guard actually was issuing a daily, giving BP a daily buy to go ahead and do this. And in fact, the hearings that Senator McCurdy held on July 15th on the use of the dispersant, if you actually go on and you review those hearings, you'll see that Lisa Jackson repeatedly contradicts herself to the point where it's very obvious that she's lying. She's not telling the truth. And in fact, Senator McCurdy demanded that the EPA supply her with information from NATO allies as to what research they had done on Corexit, its uses, and what were their policies. And I've been in touch with the senator's office trying to find out if that request was complied with, and apparently it has not been. So they're looking into that right now, but it's obviously a very reasonable question. What are our allies? What's their position on this? Britain has banned it altogether. That has a little different issues from us. Their coastal, the rocky shores that they have along Great Britain are a little different from what we have here, but the fact remains that it's completely banned there, and here we have a British company that's putting more than anyone's ever considered using in any location previously in our Gulf of Mexico, and it's having serious impacts on not only the marine life, but on the people on shore, on American citizens.
I think that one of the big concerns is what it's going to do to the crabs and the oysters and all the other wildlife there. And now, what about, you know, we'd heard some stories that there were a lot of whales and dolphins and seals and things like that that had died. Did you see any evidence of that, or did you hear anything about it?
Oh, I heard numerous firsthand accounts. That was a tremendously, it was, I guess black ops is the term that usually falls under. It was a coordinated campaign early on to, as soon as the first incident was actually out at the source, and fishermen and workers out there describe dead marine life, whales, dolphins, fish, anything you can imagine, as far as the eye could see. It was immediately after those reports kind of surfaced and were quashed that they started locking down the airspace. They started restricting air traffic over the Gulf. And it was changing all the time. You could be in the air, and they would change it on you while you were in the air, restrict further airspace. And then they closed up the shorelines. Again, this is the Coast Guard that was doing that in association with Department of Homeland Security and the FAA. So you had numerous federal agencies involved in this. And obviously, they did not want the public seeing these large, large numbers of marine life, especially the larger, the mammals that were dying in the ocean. This is just not, you don't have to be an environmentalist to have your stomach churn at these images. So they did everything they could for a long time to hide that, and they were very successful. I talked to workers that were on some of these boats. They were not allowed to take cell phones on, no cameras, no electronics of any kind. They had to sign non-disclosure agreements. The ones that did talk were very nervous about talking. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty well known that this occurred down there. It's not a big secret on the coast, but they were very effective at keeping it out of the media.
So they really blacked this out. There was no transparency at all. Now, certainly, was it Corexit that they use on the Valdez oil spill up there on the coast of Alaska?
It's very, very a tiny amount compared to what's been used on the Gulf here.
About 2 million gallons, my understanding, they've used down the Gulf. Now, if you go up on the Internet, ladies and gentlemen, and you type in, as I just did, workers on Valdez cleanup died. The first item is CNN, titled Almost All Exxon Valdez Cleanup Crews Dead. Second, Warning to Gulf Volunteers, Almost Every Cleanup Worker from the... And then the next one is... Most Exxon Valdez cleanup workers are dead. Next one is almost all of the Exxon Valdez oil spill workers are dead. The next one is, and so it goes in Shreveport, nearly every cleanup worker from. So, ladies and gentlemen, why don't we talk about that? I mean, why is that on the evening news when they're using the same substance there? I did a radio program recently when some fellow called in and said, why, a terrible thing to talk about, the danger of Corexit and that. I mean, after all, I work with pesticides all the time, and there's nothing to worry about, and nobody who works with pesticides, I get sick, and they check this all the time, and I've used this for years. And as far as the Valdez oil spill, why, Sarah Palin and her husband worked on that oil spill, and they didn't hurt them. Well, I don't know what happened up at the time of the oil spill, so I couldn't really counter this, but I went home, checked it out. Of course, what happened during the Valdez oil spill is Sarah Palin's husband went up to work on the North Slope, and Sarah Palin didn't go down there. The man was just simply, frankly, lying And this is what they do. They seem to have people in the audience calling talk-in shows saying there's just nothing to worry about, ladies and gentlemen. And yet, of course, you've talked to an awful lot of people down there along the Gulf towns that pretty are ill and having a lot of pulmonary symptoms, right? Didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, a long, long list of people that I personally spoke to, and I'll personally be following that up with we'll have additional articles with a lot of lab reports coming out next week. And it's been surprising the mainstream media has very little interest in telling the truth about what's going on there in terms of both the loss of marine life and especially the effect on the human population, the health and welfare impacts. We went to to all the major networks. I spoke to producers at CNN, at MSNBC, at CBS, at ABC, and with CBS, they actually interviewed. We set up the interviews, and I was there when they did them with some of the people that I talked to. But after the interviews got to New York, the San Francisco affiliate, the anchor there, was very big on this story. Dana, I forget the beautiful lady, I forget her last name. She was very big on getting this story out, but it got killed in New York. So, it's fairly amusing the extent of corporate influence in the media.
Well, the media is controlled, Jerry. I've been at this for the better part of 50 years. I can tell you, I've had people working in the media tell me, if I went on this radio station and said what I really believe, I'd be fired tomorrow. And I've heard this from numerous sources. So we've got a real problem. And this is why I think it's so important that we get the information out that you're putting out, and we get people to... we'll be back here in just a moment with Jerry Cope, who is actually down there for a couple of weeks and has a fascinating story to tell. Jerry, go right ahead.
Well, anyway, I was just sort of referring to the extent of the media just relaying whatever information that they receive from...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey Water Filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey Water Company. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitman with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our Founding Fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Issues, especially climate-related issues, more on a global strategy level than on anything else. I do some writing and I do some filmmaking and media, but mainly it's focused on climate-related issues. And I do get there's certain times, especially here at home in the U.S., when an issue gets to be kind of a critical mass, and I get enough calls and people talking to me about it that I'll put everything else aside. I did in April. I spent the month in West Virginia with I took Charlie Annenberg from the Annenberg Foundation after the latest mine disaster there. And I'd had contact with a lot of people there on mountaintop removal issues, so we went and spent a month looking around, seeing how we might be able to help the community down there. And most of our time was spent in the Whitesville area, and we managed to get funding completed for a new elementary school and some other community projects, so that was a good use of time. And then I was getting a lot of calls about what was going on down in the coast, and nobody was really talking about what actually was going on down there. It was being covered up. So Charles Hamilton, who is a friend of mine, and he produced The Cove last year and won the Oscar for Best Documentary, Charles and I finally decided that we should go down there and see if we couldn't get some people to talk to us on the record about what was going on and get the story out so that perhaps some resources could go down there to help these people as opposed to just covering it up and making it look like a pretty picture.
All right, fine. So did you actually get to fly over into that area at all?
Yes. Bonnie Schumacher, a brilliant scientist, she does a lot of work. She's got two big projects at JPL right now. And we'd never met before, but we have a lot of mutual friends. Anyway, Bonnie had been down there off and on with her plane, and we spent 2 days flying over the entire Gulf, all the way from Louisiana to Florida, out beyond the source and then back in. And we saw in 2 days, well, the entire Gulf is covered with Corexit. I mean, everything, everywhere you look, it's green and foamy, and the water has this weird texture to it. As far as the eye can see, the entire Gulf. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of this chemical they've used down there. And then the amazing thing was there's nothing moving, and the Gulf of Mexico was teeming with life before this happened. In 2 days, we saw 4 dolphins and 3 schools of rays and very, very few birds. And, I mean, if you've ever been out in the Gulf before, you know that's so far from normal, it's actually a little bit scary.
Well, you know, the thing that bothers me is if they just hadn't sprayed the Corexit, I mean, and they'd go ahead and put the cap on there, you know, in the first week, there wouldn't have been a problem at all. Why did they put the cap on initially? Why did they wait 3 months before they put the cap on? That doesn't make sense.
Well, it's hard to make sense. You're right. It is hard to make sense out of that. But it was a complicated situation. They actually started running into trouble, and it all started going to hell in February when originally they first had some fractures and blowouts in the canyon. And then, of course, it really went bad, and they brought over the Russian Mir submarine, and one of the Russian scientists that was on board who has dealt with these kind of blowouts before, and he's actually the guy who has successfully used nuclear explosions to seal them up in the past. When he went down and actually looked at the ocean floor, he described it as a fractured windshield on an automobile, that they had messed this thing up so bad that there really was no way that they had to address the problem. They have, there's methane flares, there's seven huge methane flares as far as 60, 100 miles away from the source. And actually, it was when one of those got lit up that they shut all the satellites down over the Gulf, so you could no longer get any imaging, no infrared, and that's also when they removed all the data from the Thomas Jefferson, the NOAA ship, which maps the ocean floor out there. So, you know, it just went to hell in a handbasket. And they actually, I've talked to several people. They haven't been willing to go on the record for obvious reasons, but the U.S. government seriously was looking at using nuclear weapons down there to seal this thing up, and apparently that's the only permanent long-term solution, but politically it's dynamite. So once they went ahead and tried the cap, and once they were able to do that and it looked good on TV, then they did away with the plan of using nuclear weapons and just let PP go ahead with the cap, even though it didn't address the problem of the methane flares. And that's also why the pressure on that wellhead never got above 6,800 PSI when it should have gone up to 100,000.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Jerry Cope, and we're simply talking about what went on down there in the Gulf that you're not hearing about from regular channels. So, Jerry, pick the story up from there. You're basically saying then that they have this whole floor of this canyon is shattered, and they have methane leaks all up and down. Won't putting in some other wells, can't they decompress that area to take the pressure off the oil field?
Well, you know, the field is so big and it's so extensive that the pressure is being relieved by all these fractures and the flares that they've created. There's really not a problem with the pressure inside the reservoir underneath the ocean floor. It's venting itself right now, which is what I was saying. That's why once they capped that thing, it never got above 6,800. You can go back and look at all the BP statements, and Thad Allen, the incident commander, you can look at his statements, and of course they expected it to hit a minimum of 8,000 PSI. Well, you know, it never got close, and that's the reason. But, what they're really after, and I believe, there's no reason not to believe that this is true, is that, the President of the United States made a deal with BP initially that, they were going to let them take as long as they needed to cap this thing in a manner in which they could still recover the oil out of it so that BP wouldn't lose their investment. That was the whole purpose. It wasn't to seal this thing up. It wasn't to keep the oil out of the Gulf. It was a dog and pony show that they were going to run as long as they needed to so that BP could do this in a manner where they can still extract the oil from the reservoir.
Well, are they going to put other shafts down there? Do you think other wells down into that reservoir? Because it sounds like a fantastic source of oil.
Well, I would be very surprised. surprised if they did not, but I have no idea what their long-term plans are. I do know that, you know, originally this project was deemed by every expert in the world and all the top drilling experts, the guys that have done this in the North Sea, all over, they all agreed unanimously that this was a terrible idea.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Jerry. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Jerry Copeland. He's an environmentalist, and he, because people were asking him to go down, he went down. And as he says, as they flew over the water there, over the Gulf, instead of being blue, it was green, and it was foamy, and it was just this core exit, the detergent there, on the, which had just changed the whole of the surface of the Gulf as far as they could see when they were flying over this. So, and then, of course, an awful lot of people in the oil drilling business thought that, you know, putting this shaft down a mile and then going down another 300,000 or 400,000, another 3 or 4 miles was a very, very difficult and very, very dangerous thing to do. And yet, BP did it, and of course, we know what the result was. But we haven't been told the truth. Tremendous cover-up, apparently a tremendous loss of sea life, and as Jerry says, the oyster beds are all dead along the coast, and it's probably primarily related to the core exit, although probably the oil doesn't help at all. And then, of course, the new oysters are something they're not living, and there's been so much death of sea life there, and the crabs and all, and this is just going to decimate the economics of the Gulf for a long, long period of time. But certainly the thing that is most disconcerting is the damage to health, and everything was done to keep the people out there working in the Gulf from protecting themselves from the fumes of the core exit, and they knew how deadly it was, because almost, and you can go up on the internet and check this out, almost everybody who worked on the Valdez cleanup is now dead. And the efforts are being made to conceal that, specifically from the people who were out there working in the Gulf. My understanding is that they were working in the Gulf and they wanted to wear a respirator. They just got fired. And, of course, an awful lot of them are sick and probably will never recover, just exactly as it was of the people who worked on the Twin Towers. An awful lot of them have died, and the government knew how toxic it was. And they had them work there anyway, and most of them without respirators. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But before we go on, Jerry, would you like to go ahead and get your website out, or where people can get your information?
Well, the best place to get information is, and we're continuing to publish articles on this. They're getting linked all over the web, but if you go to the Huffington Post, which is just thehuffingtonpost.com, and if you just put in my name, Jerry Cope, then you'll pull up all my archive. And so far we've published two big articles on this. The first was on the animal cover-up. There's a lot of photographs, there's a lot of interviews with people, there's links to other places you can look for additional information. But it's something. We've got two more big articles coming out next week. And, we'll continue to pursue this as long as it takes. I went down there because I wanted to see if I couldn't help these people. And once I got down there and met them, then I became even more determined to see that through. It's just not acceptable in a democracy for our society and our system of government to work. There has to be transparency. And in this incident, there has been zero transparency.
Well, Jerry, I hate to tell you, but we do not have a transparent government. We have an invisible government, and you see the visible government. You don't see the invisible government. The visible government is responsive to the people. The invisible government runs things, and they do exactly what they want to, and they don't care what the people think. Well, let's go. We've got Rowan calling here. Rowan, where are you calling from?
Yes, Dr. Stan. I'm upstate New York.
All right, fine. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Did you have a question for our guest?
Just a brief comment.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. Enjoy your program. That dispersant they were using, I realize what a danger that is. I just wanted to share something. There was a brief airing of a product similar to that on TV about a month ago, and they were out of Houston, and they showed this dispersant stacked up, and they insisted that their particular product was very, very safe, you know, for what it had to do. It was non-toxic, and they were trying to get the people to, you know, responsible for that to use that product instead of that Corexin. And I think, as far as they completely ignored them.
Well, I think there were a number of, Jerry, there were a number of other things they could have used, weren't there?
There is, there's a tremendous any number of options that are far, far more desirable than the Corexin. It's absolutely true. But you have, you know, this, the reason that they used it was because of a close relationship with the manufacturer, and, you know, this gets into some other big oil companies that are players in the Gulf, and Monsanto is also a factor here. So, you know, it's, I don't like to sign on to global conspiracy theories, but in this particular instance, it's hard to ignore that all of these people came together to make this happen, and the bad effects of it.
And of course, I think that this is going to have a profound impact on further drilling down there in the Gulf. I suspect that the temporary ban, you know, for 6 months will be extended, but we'll have to wait and see. Maybe I'm just a little paranoid. Anything else you want to say, Rowan, before we let you go?
Yes, I just felt really sad in the last few days that I understood that Matt Simmons had suddenly passed away last Sunday.
All right, fine.
He was a reporter on that, and I know he'll be missed.
All right, fine. Thanks so much. Do you know anything at all about Matt Simmons at all, Jerry?
Yes, yes. It's actually, it's an unfortunate loss, and yeah, we're all a little bit poorer for his not being around.
Well, what happened to him? Was he an older man? Was it?
You know, I don't know the details. It was a sudden death, and Matt had been doing a lot of work on these same issues, and I really don't know the exact circumstances, but it was sudden and unfortunate, and he was also digging and not taking any answers at face value.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and you're going to get a different slant on this than you're going to get elsewhere. And according to Jerry, why, of course, the BP went down, and they got suddenly the hospitals to sign all sorts of agreements, a lot of the doctors there, so that the people who were ill couldn't get medical care at the hospital or even sometimes from their own personal doctors. Why in heaven's name would they try to get doctors not to, you know, take care of the people who are having these respiratory problems after coming in contact with the toxic fumes of the oil and the methane, the sulfur dioxide, and then, of course, of the Corexit? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You'd think you'd want them to get taken care of so that, you know, they would recover and get well again.
Well, the problem is that what they're exposing people to, number one, the long-term effects have never been studied. Exxon was very successful in thwarting any long-term studies from Exxon Valdez. And BP, you know, it all boils down to financial issues. But if it can be shown that as a result of this spill, that people are ill and that they have in fact been exposed to these highly toxic volatile organic compounds and they're in their system, then BP becomes responsible for long-term medical surveillance, and that is extremely expensive, and you know, forget about the fines that they're going to have to pay and the economic losses, the cost to try to deal with the health impacts of this on millions and millions of people, I don't know that they would even be capable of achieving that. I think it would probably put them out of business, but then, you know, the word is that if that does come to pass, that they're simply going to be absorbed by another company and British Petroleum will no longer be a functioning corporation.
Well, how far inland would the people be susceptible to this? You mentioned, of course, that the Corexit, evidence of Corexit and the other toxins have been found in rainwater inland.
Well, we'll add more information next week, which is going to be more definitive on this, and I think is going to start the ball rolling in a big way in starting to address that. But from the information we have so far and the limited studies that we've done, and the bigger ones are going to be, the data is going to be available by midweek next week, we're fairly certain at this point that it's not a reach, that it goes in at least 2 to 10 miles, and as you mentioned earlier, this is an agricultural zone. There are tremendous amount of crops that are grown in this area. We do know that for whatever reason, the potato crops have been damaged and in some cases are completely destroyed. As far as the effects on other vegetation, that's still not determined yet, but those studies are starting to be put underway. But they, you know, it's been difficult to raise the funding for that because the government and BP have had zero interest in pursuing any of these questions or getting answers to them.
Well, I would hope. I hate to think that you have to go to trial attorneys to get any sort of justice. But we've seen that as far as tobacco is concerned, and we've seen this with other issues. And unfortunately, we may very well have to rely upon the trial attorneys who have a vested financial interest to get the truth out there.
It's very possible that that's where it's going to wind up.
Well, anyway, of course, now as far as the economy down there, is the economy pretty well wiped out down along? Now, what is this? Is this primarily a Louisiana? Is it Alabama? What was it?
Well, it runs, you know, Louisiana is a bit more diversified, but, you know, in terms of all the fishing and the commercial fishing, you know, it's right now it's absolutely devastated. And probably even, or at least as bad as that, I shouldn't say it's worse, I don't think it gets worse, but then as you move east along the Mississippi and the Alabama and the Florida coast, you know, in the past 20, 30 years, you've had this tremendous development. You have high-rise luxury condos all along miles and miles and miles of beach, you know, same as on Florida in Miami or Lauderdale, any of these areas. But the tremendous number of high-rise, very expensive condominiums, and basically these people have really about a 3-month window to make their income for the year. It's the summer months are when they generate their revenue, and it's got to carry them through the year. Well, this year there hasn't been a summer. The summer of 2010 is over, and it never even got started. You already have people moving out of the area, businesses are already closing and failing. That's just going to increase exponentially over the next few months. British Petroleum and the government have done nothing to help them. What they've offered them is nowhere near the amount that's being lost, and they're very slow to pay when they do pay. So I don't even know how you begin to assess the economic devastation, but it's certainly nothing anyone was prepared for, and you have lives that are being shattered. They're just people that live there, their livelihoods, their families. It's simply total devastation.
Well, of course, the thing is that my contention is I don't know why they couldn't have put that cap on much, much earlier than they did. We'll just have to, maybe one day we'll have some idea of what really has gone on there. But right now we know that they're controlling our access to information, which is why I'm so glad that you went down there and talked to the people. But this is going to have a tremendous economic devastation on that area, in addition to the fact we're already in a recession. But this certainly can wipe out the fishing all along that area, the tourism all along that area. But I think the most devastating thought is how many people are going to have permanent physical disability or going to die because of the toxicity, the chemicals that they were exposed to, and totally unnecessarily, because there were certainly many other detergents that had no harmful human effects, and yet animal effects, and yet, of course, they would not allow those to be used. The only ones they could use were those produced by a company with close ties to British Petroleum. I think that's criminal in my estimation.
I think it's absolutely criminal, and I think the worst part of that whole formula is that there are protocols that could have been used. The workers that were out there could have been in full hazmat gear. They could have had respirators. They weren't allowed to use any respirators. They were allowed to use boots and gloves, which is totally inadequate. So it's pretty clear that BP places a very, very low value on human life.
I'm very much afraid that you're right. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for Jerry. But he's been down there. He's seen it. He's talked to the people there. Are people scared? I mean, did you get this feeling that a lot of people were frightened to talk to you for fear that they might get into trouble?
It was dependent somewhat on which issue we were discussing. Anyone that was working for BP or a subcontractor was very scared to discuss anything, because they had been specifically instructed not to speak to the media at all. They were not anxious to speak to me, and it, understandably, because this is the only source of income that especially these fishermen and the tour boat people who had been hired by PP for the Vessel Opportunity Program, where they were paid $1,300 to $3,000 a day to go out and kind of spot for the oil. All of these people, it's the only source of income that they had or could look forward to in the near future. So they didn't want to jeopardize their employment. And I certainly remain sympathetic to that position. And, the government was actually somewhat more forthcoming. Some of the Coast Guard people that were totally disgusted by what they were being forced to do and commanded to do in terms of assisting BP and lying to people. Some of the EPA senior officials actually in D.C. have been calling me off the record since I started publishing articles on this, and the EPA, these people that have worked there for their entire careers and take their jobs seriously and try to do the right thing, are very, very disillusioned, disgusted. Besides, they don't know what to do. They actually don't have many options as to what they can do at this point. One told me earlier last week that Lisa Jackson had issued a directive to hold all litigation against BP, and no action was to be taken at the present time. So there's a lot of very, very unhappy people, and some of them are willing to talk, and then some of them are just too scared to.
What a tragic situation is in America when people are afraid to talk and speak out about what's going on. But ladies and gentlemen, this has happened many times before, and people who done too much talking sometimes they meet strange accidents. Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. So basically, what's the message you'd like to leave with our listeners, Jerry?
Well, I think the probably one of the greatest messages to be learned here is
heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm
I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
And from a logical point of view, if you understand that there is a population control agenda out there, and Sydney, if you go open the internet though and check out that story of the Valdez, and just type in Sydney Valdez cleanup death workers, death among workers, Valdez cleanup, something of like that sort, and you'll find that what we're telling is true. Now, if this is true, why would they use the same toxic substance down there in the Gulf of Mexico? Doesn't make sense unless there's another agenda. If you haven't heard my population control agenda, planned population reduction, you really need to get that DVD. And then my talk on Dundare College Genocide, my talk on population control. And then, of course, you can get the written component. It's called the Population Control Agenda. The Population Control Agenda, you can get that on the internet. Just type that in or put my name, Population Control, and you can pull it down. If you get any of the other items from it, we'll be glad to go ahead and to provide you a free copy of the pamphlet, and we want you to copy it and get it to people and let them understand there really are evil and wicked people out there who want to kill a large part of the world's population. Now, what do we know about British Petroleum? Well, Peter Sutherland, of course, who is the former CEO of British Petroleum, sold a great deal of his stock shortly before this happened. He left and went to work for some other company. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission. And then, of course, you understand the people who control, certainly the Obama administration are affiliated with the Trilateral Commission. And then if you understand that there really is a small little group of people, a few thousand people who run the world, and British Petroleum, Exxon, and Chevron, those are both Rockefeller-controlled. British Petroleum ties into the British monarchy. Royal Dutch Shell ties into the Dutch monarchy, and they all work together. Part of the bloc nobility of Europe and certainly the financial elite of the West. And they're working to create a new world, but not so many people in. In fact, they even put in a doomsday seed bank up there above the Arctic Circle in Norway. They put in the doomsday seed bank with good seeds. Because, of course, they're destroying our crops now with genetic engineering. If you haven't got our 4-tape set on genetic engineering, if you haven't read the book we offer called Genetic Roulette, or you can go up at newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com, and look up the articles by Jeffrey Smith. Or just type in Jeffrey Smith, genetic engineering, the Russian scientific studies. You'll find out they found all sorts of information in Russia about how the genetically modified food destroys fertility. Not only in this generation, but in generations yet unborn, two or three generations down the line, the animals that they did this with couldn't reproduce. Understand, they know what they're doing. They understand what they're doing with bisphenol. They understand what they're doing with phthalates. They understand what they're doing, certainly with vaccinations, with aspartame. They understand what they're doing with the chemicals. They understand what they're doing with water fluoridation. They just don't want you to understand. And you need to find out if I'm telling you the truth. You need to get my talk on the specter haunting America. The Specter Haunting America, Vaccines and Brain Development by Dr. Blaylock, Mercury Autism and the Global Vaccine Agenda by Dr. Ayub, and you get a free CD-ROM with that, with several thousand pages of scientific studies on mercury. But it's not just mercury, it's the whole vaccine process. They know what they're doing. They know about the aluminum in it. But they don't want you to know, ladies and gentlemen. They're destroying the health of our children. 1 in 9 American children has asthma. 1 in 11 or 12 has severe allergies. 1 in 6 has a learning disability. 1 in 66 boys is autistic. And you don't see it in children who haven't been vaccinated. I wonder why. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grigg. And William, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it is always a blessing to be with you on Friday night. Thank you so much for having me as a guest once again.
Well, for those of you who don't know William, he used to be the senior editor for the New American Magazine, and now, of course, he has his own blog, he writes his books, he has his own radio program, but he's regularly a guest here every Friday evening, and I always look forward to it, because you can go up on the Internet and find all sorts of significant articles, very thoughtful and thought-provoking articles by William Grigg. So what are we going to be talking about tonight, William?
Dr. Stan, I don't know if you discussed this, but this incident that occurred just within the last couple of days in Georgia is such a harbinger of what we're going to be facing in the coming years. I think we need to talk about it. I'm referring, of course, to the spectacle in, I believe, the the urban areas called East Fulton, or forgive me, South Fulton City, which, if memory serves, is a suburb of Atlanta. You have three-quarters of the city turnout in order to obtain applications for Section 8 housing. The city is about 40,000 in total population. An estimated 30,000 people showed up in 95-plus degree weather in order to obtain applications for subsidized housing, for housing vouchers that would help them pay the rent and defray housing costs. And these are vouchers, or rather applications for vouchers that would be issued, the vouchers, that is, would be issued probably within the next several years. But people are in such a state of indigency that many of these people were willing to abide 95-plus degree temperatures in the company of 30,000 people equally desperate as they in order to obtain these applications in the vague hope that someday they'll be able to get these housing subsidies. You had 30,000 people show up, 62 people were injured, riot police were called out in force, no arrests were made, but you had this huge rugby scrum of desperate people, the photographs of which resemble nothing so much as scenes that we have witnessed from third world countries.
No, but basically, how many grants are they going to give? How many of these subsidized housing?
That's not clear.
I mean, are we talking about 10,000? Are we talking about 5,000? Are we talking about 1,000? Are we talking about a few hundred? This is the way it's used.
Probably a few hundred. And you had, of course, such a disproportion here in terms of the number of people who are grabbing the applications, the number of spots that someday may be open. What I'm thinking, of course, is that they're building up sort of what you could call excess capacity here in terms of the number of people to be making demands for Section 8 housing. And once again, these are vouchers that would only be issued probably years from now, if ever. And this, once again, is, I think, a really important portent of the direction our country's heading. And this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, there was a spectacle at the Cobo Center in Detroit. Detroit, of course, is, as I've said before, sort of a municipal moonscape, an economic wasteland. It really has completely fallen apart. You've got the city that was once the diadem of our manufacturing economy now becoming a dying city. And indeed, it is in its death throes right now. And you had a very similar spectacle take place there last fall.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. But what we're increasingly seeing, there's a new legislation they're trying to put through, which will require certainly the government to have a voter registration places, any place where you can get food stamps or welfare. In other words, if you're applying for food stamps or welfare, why we want to make sure you're going to vote, so you'll vote for the people who give you food stamps and welfare. They're required for federal elections. They will have these places there. Well, a society like ours can only exist until people find that they can vote themselves into the public trough. And then, of course, the whole system implodes. And we're well on our way to that. We'll be right back. Well, William, because what happens is everybody gets at the public trough, and then there are fewer and fewer people working.
Yeah.
Right now, as far as our Social Security is concerned, we've got about three people working for every person on Social Security, but within a few years, why, there'll be one person working for every person on Social Security, and when that person realizes that a significant part of their salary is going to to fund those who are retired, why, pretty soon they're just going to quit working and go on welfare as well, and then the whole system implodes financially. In fact, we're well on the way to that. Right now, we're going to put out more money in Social Security this year and next year than we're going to take in, but they tell us everything's fine. We've got this Social Security fund, without, of course, telling you that the money's all been spent, and then they have to, of course, pay off those bonds. Why, they just go out and borrow the money. That's part of the $5 billion we're borrowing every day. But go right ahead, William.
Yeah, the $5 billion we're borrowing every day, and now we see, once again, if we can somehow penetrate the studied opacity of the system, we can see that the Federal Reserve is in the business right now of buying its own debt, which, of course, is something the Federal Reserve has done at various intervals in our history, and it's always led to catastrophe, and we're headed for probably a world historic catastrophe in terms of the complete repudiation of the fiat dollar within the next couple of years because of what you were just describing, Dr. Stan. And the self-nullifying proposition at the heart of socialism most memorably expressed in Karl Marx's depraved daydream, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, the self-nullifying nature of that proposition is that it places a premium on need rather than ability or performance. And so naturally, when you are rewarded for being needy, you've got no incentive to perform and be productive. And the entire economic philosophy, if you torture the word philosophy into applying here, of the Obama regime is based on the idea that government is omnipotent, that it has limitless funds, limitless resources, and a basically infinite ability to extract from the productive through coercion to the benefit of those who are on the receiving end, those who are the needy.
But William, the thing is that these are not stupid people. The people
who
are behind this whole thing know what they're doing, and they know it's going to destroy the system, and they're going to be there to pick up the pieces. They're intentionally doing this. This is what people find difficult to believe. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're intentionally destroying this once great nation.
Yeah, I don't think that the people we're talking about are anywhere near as intelligent as they flatter themselves to be. I think you're dealing with people who have got a badly exaggerated sense of their acumen, of their accomplishments, of their insight. That being said, these are, as you say, Dr. Stan, not stupid people. They're well-educated people, albeit educated in bad tenets and nostrums. They're people of certainly above-average intelligence.
Hold that thought. Well, William is just talking about the people who are working behind the scenes, bringing this great nation of ours to its knees and destroying the financial stability of this nation because, of course, socialism doesn't work. And eventually, of course, everybody gets on the dole and then there's nobody working. And where does the money come from? Then, of course, you have to have then that with the whip getting people back to work again. And all these people who have been getting these wonderful pensions are going to find the pensions aren't there. All the people who are getting these wonderful benefits from government are going to find that there's no money. And so at that point, of course, all freedom is lost.
Yeah. Because there's nothing left in the economy. The economy has completely been destroyed. It's been rendered inert. You've basically persecuted the productive into oblivion. And that's something that I think is a prospect not on the distant horizon. I think that's one that's approaching us very rapidly, much more rapidly than people would assume. And spectacles of the sort that we've seen in Atlanta a couple of days ago, or in the Atlanta suburbs, and in Detroit last fall, once again, are very important auguries of the times that are going to befall us, not merely with respect to housing, housing, of course, being one of the most important rudimentary physical needs, but also with respect to food and with respect to energy and with respect to all the necessities of life. Once again, in the Obama administration, the people who were the front people, if you will, those who were fronting for the concealed oligarchy, this particular brand of collectivists we're dealing with right now. We had a different brand of collectivism under George W. Bush. We've got a slightly different flavor of the month or flavor of this quadrennium right now. But the people who are fronting are folks who are of above-average intelligence and above-average educational attainment, so we have to rule out, as you say, stupidity. Stupidity can only explain so much. We're not dealing with stupid people. I'm not qualified to diagnose these people in terms of their mental health, and so I don't think we're dealing with clinical derangement. That leaves, I think, by process of deduction, evil, intentional, deliberate, purposive evil in terms of the policies that they are pursuing at the expense of our liberty and our prosperity. And when you see these policies metastasized into third world spectacles of tumult and violence of the sort that we saw in Atlanta, the Atlanta suburbs, a couple of days ago, that's a very important symptom of a disease that is going to inflame the entire body politic as this economy continues to degenerate. And there's nothing going on in the economy right now that would prevent this, because everything that is being done while we're treating this disease is, as you would appreciate being a medical doctor, iatrogenic in nature. It is a treatment that makes the malady worse. They're treating this affliction of inflation in terms of excessive credit and monetary creation with greater increments of the same affliction, and eventually that destroys an economy outright. I just want to advert once again to what happened in Detroit last October. I don't know the specifics with respect to the number of Section 8 housing applications that were being distributed in South Fulton a couple of days ago, but in Detroit last October, you had at least 25,000 applications filled out within less than 3 minutes. I mean, this is not merely 25,000 people who were there. They had 25,000 applications filled out in a 3-minute span
for 3,500 available vouchers. And, of course, he had a much larger crowd than that, and it got to the point where no voucher applications were available. And so some scam artist materialized who started selling photocopies of the original applications for $20 each. And, of course, each of these photocopies had clearly written at the bottom a legend dictating do not duplicate, must submit original application. But in spite of that, you had people show up from the municipal government of Detroit, acting, of course, on behalf of the federal government, which is funding this whole madhouse, who were willing to take those duplicated, bogus applications for Section 8 housing vouchers, of which they no longer had any. So obviously, you're dealing once again with excess demand as opposed to the supply of available welfare recipient or welfare assets. And that, I cannot overemphasize this. This is merely a foretaste. And it's only in one area of the broad spectrum of physical necessities, albeit a very important one. Housing, of course, is a fundamental human need. But once again, the government is creating this huge and roiling constituency of needy people with no economic prospects, and many of the people within that cohort, not everybody. I want to make this clear. Not everybody who is facing indigency right now is somebody who is inured to collectivist ideas. Not everybody who finds himself out of work and struggling is eager and anxious to live at the expense of others. There are many people who are doing what they can within the compass of their abilities and their opportunities to support themselves even now. But the problem is we've had how many decades of concentrated collectivist miseducation in this country? How many generations have been raised up within the self-sustaining welfare milieu in which the government is essentially their surrogate father? They've been raised by single mothers. This is not something that is race specific. Granted, it started among the urban black population. It certainly has not remained an affliction contained to the urban black population. This is something that has spread out beyond that cohort into the larger population. And altogether, too frequently you find single mothers raising children with the government as the surrogate parent, the surrogate father. And this is the way that the system was designed. Very quickly, if we go back and look at the origins of the modern welfare state in the policies of Britain's Fabian socialists, the early years of the 20th century, this is something G.K. Chesterton wrote about with great passion and in great detail because he's somebody who knew those personalities, the Sidney and Beatrice Webb, H.G. Wells, people of that kidney. G.K. Chesterton, Gilbert Chesterton, wrote about the evil designs of the Fabian socialists for capitalizing on the needs of peripheral hard cases in order to bring about the comprehensive subversion of the natural family to advance the parenthood of the state. It's a concept best summarized in the Latin phrase parens patriae. And you can see references to parens patriae in legal decisions here in the United States going back to the mid-19th century with respect to government education and things of that sort. But H.G. Wells, who was one of the most capable exponents of the Fabian socialist view, wrote a book back in the 19-teens called New Worlds for Old, in which he talked about the idea of making the mother the recipient of public welfare benefits and putting the state in the place of the father, the father, of course, not being present, or the father being present. In either case, the government would become, in effect, the chief breadwinner and the head of the home. And because it would assume that role, H.G. Wells said, it will dictate how the children would be raised. And if the children were not being raised in a way that the people administering state programs considered suitable, then they would be taken from the mother in question, and then they would be raised more directly by those whom the state would consider to be more suitable custodians of its property, meaning the children. And that's the fundamental tenet behind just about every welfare program, not only in socialist Britain, but here in the United States, particularly the Great Society programs that came on track in the 1960s, many of which were designed by a Russian expatriate and Soviet, more importantly, Soviet sociologist by the name of Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who was one of the chief architects of things like Head Start and many of the other early child intervention programs that have helped to cultivate this dependency, this neediness, this institutionalized, self-reinforcing and self-perpetuating dependence on the state. We've had that going on for over half a century now in this country, and now, of course, we have a whole population, tens of millions strong or larger, of people who are congenitally incapable by virtue of the environment which they grew up and the education, miseducation they've received, of conceiving of themselves as independent of government aid and support. And, of course, this is something which is starting in a lot of these urban regions that have historically been blighted by government intervention, the saturating influence, malignant influence of government welfare and these programs that studiously and systematically disrupt the family. But it's not going to be confined to these regions, and it's very important to recognize that everywhere in this country where you have a deep and ever-deepening housing depression, where you have people who are underwater on their mortgages and dealing with non-existent household savings and credit lines that have become chains of bondage, people who are in parlous circumstances with respect to their employment, people who are unemployed, or two-income households that needed both incomes and now only have one, and that income is being scaled back. We have situations like that that tend to aggregate into large economic pits. You're going to see the same things happening in different ways, perhaps as a result of different disease vectors, but you're going to have the same kinds of things that we have seen in Atlanta and Detroit. And ironically enough, many people wouldn't think that this would be the case, but two really good candidates for this would be Las Vegas and Phoenix. Now, Las Vegas and Phoenix are not monolithically or even predominantly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. They both have a great deal of ethnic diversity and sociological diversity. Both of them, of course, have had large problems with unrestricted immigration. Phoenix, of course, being in Arizona, is sort of the marquee example of the same. But Phoenix and Arizona, or Phoenix and Las Vegas, rather, were two of the largest and most conspicuous growth areas during the housing bubble. As a matter of fact, both of them, I think, in the case of both Phoenix and Las Vegas, you saw a sort of delirium take place, where it was literally impossible to avoid being caught either in the wave, the tidal wave, or in the undertow of the Fed's engineered housing bubble. And now that the bubble's burst, both of them are sinking into an economic black hole, and they're really good candidates for the same kind of turmoil that we've seen in Atlanta and in Detroit.
But, of course, eventually, William, the federal government is not going to be able to have the money. The federal government's incomes are down, and their expenditures are increasing. They keep going from conflict to conflict, and, you know, we're staying in Afghanistan. We're probably going to be going to war with Iran. We've got to have this Medicare assist program, new health care program. It's going to be very expensive, but Barack Obama is simply lying about that. Where is the money going to come from? If you increase taxes, you decrease productivity, and you decrease government income. We'll be back in just a moment here. And, of course, the big thing is the government can make all these promises.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Had to have an enemy so he could rally the people behind the government. And it's a trick as old as time. And right now, of course, we can see this right now with the wicked Ahmadinejad who threatens to destroy the United States. That's, of course, if we attack him. But after all, he's a threat to the United States. So we've got to attack them. And the real question whether they really are working on a nuclear bomb. So the intelligence agencies say they're not, but that doesn't matter. The media insists that Iran is just on the verge of getting a bomb, and once they get the bomb, they will threaten the entire world, and we couldn't allow Iran to have a nuclear bomb. Of course, it's all right that China has nuclear bombs, that Russia has nuclear bombs, that Pakistan and India and Israel have nuclear bombs in that area. But we cannot allow Iran to get a nuclear bomb, and that's why we're going to have to go to war. But go right ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly the gambit that's being played right now, is to try to manufacture a frenzy over the supposed potential threat, the prospective threat that's always referred to in the subjunctive mood here, if this, then that, represented supposedly by the Iranian government. And Iran is a really good example of a country that is distant enough and has a checkered enough history with the United States that it serves a very good hate object for the purpose of this ancient strategy of redirecting all of the turbulent humors of the kingdom into a foreign crusade, like sewer water in a gutter, to use an expression that an advisor to King Henry IV once used when talking about how to maintain the peace of the kingdom. You want to maintain the peace of the kingdom, it's a really good, very good idea to launch some kind of a foreign war. And in the last century and a half or so, there have been at least three significant economic depressions that the United States has suffered. There was one in the 1890s, there was one in the early years of the 20th century, and of course there was one in the 1930s and 1940s. And in each of those cases, one of the solutions that was seized upon by the ruling elite was to arrange a foreign war. The first was the War of 1898 with Spain. That was one that was sort of the second choice. The first choice would have been some kind of a dust-up with Great Britain over, of all the unlikely things, a border dispute in Venezuela. That really didn't play well with the American public. But then the USS Maine blew up in the harbor of Havana, and it was blamed on the Spaniards, although the Spaniards had nothing to do with it, as FDR admitted tardily about 30 years later, a little more than 30 years later. But this was the rationale used for this ripping good war that Teddy Roosevelt and others in the McKinley administration had lusted for years. And as a result, we ended up in possession of the Philippines, and we ended up as a country fighting about a decade-long counterinsurgent war that killed 2 or 3 million Filipinos and then set the stage for some disasters that ensued in the 1940s when the Japanese invaded and took over the Philippines. And that was the same Japanese empire that the Roosevelt administration had quietly been building up and abetting. Teddy Roosevelt, this is something I think I talked about last week and it's outlined in this book, Imperial Cruise, by James Bradley. Teddy Roosevelt was quietly urging the Japanese militarists to wage a war against Russia in Manchuria. He was quietly encouraging them to look upon themselves as a subcontractor for Washington to be in control of the northern Pacific as part of what he called the Japanese Monroe Doctrine. And he abetted that war, the Russo-Japanese War that began with the sneak attack on Port Arthur, that was really sort of a precursor to Pearl Harbor. And then he later on won a Nobel Peace Prize for helping to bring about a settlement to a war that he had quietly abetted. And this is something that not many people appreciate, is the fact that the plague of Japanese militarism, which later on became a real bane to the United States in the 1930s and 1940s, was something that was abetted by the ruling elite in Washington. The same thing happened, of course, with the rise of Bolshevism and the rise of National Socialism. They're always going out and confecting these enemies in order to have, I believe, a goad for strategic purposes in a geopolitical sense, and also a very handy hate figure, a very handy bogeyman to mobilize support here at home and to bewitch the intelligence of people who otherwise would look critically at what our rulers are doing to us.
I certainly agree, and the difficulty is that most people don't understand history. They don't know what's happened in the past. They find it so difficult that our leaders would actually take us into a unnecessary war. But then look at what happened with Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't occur. Go up on the internet. Now it's admitted it didn't occur. 58,000 American boys died bravely, courageously, for absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
1 million South Vietnamese died. 2 million North Vietnamese died. Who's responsible for lying to the American people? Well, nobody's ever been held responsible. It just happened. Just happened. William, you go right ahead.
On the subject of these contrived campaigns of outrage, this is something that some of your listeners might not agree with me about, but I really think that this entire controversy over the Ground Zero Mosque, so-called, is a splendid example of what we're talking about. I don't know whether it's a good idea to build this proposed Muslim cultural center a couple of blocks away from Ground Zero. May or may not be a good idea. It has no connection to September 11, 2001, because the so-called Cordoba Institute behind this originally proposed building this about 12 or 13 years ago. And this fellow, the imam, Faisal Abdul Rauf, the Kuwaiti-born U.S. citizen who's the imam behind this project, is somebody who was very close to the FBI and he was very close to the Bush administration, which in my book makes him a suspicious character, not because of his religious background, but because of his connections to the FBI and the Bush administration. But here's a guy who, when asked a couple of years ago what he would urge, what message he would urge upon the world during the month of Ramadan, which is considered a holy month by Muslims, he recited the Golden Rule, and he said something that I think is self-evidently sensible. Do unto others as thou would have them do unto you should be the operative principle of our foreign policy, and if that were American foreign policy, would be immensely popular in the world. Now, whatever you think about this guy's background or his aspirations or whatever else he may be up to, the fact that he is reciting that moral maxim I find to be commendable. And yet we see the entire cast of herd poisoners from the war party, beginning with Newt Gingrich, who's an unspeakably vile human being in terms of the way he's treated his ex-wives, in terms of the way that he has capitalized on people's anxieties and the corruption that he represents in terms of his political career. He's one of the people out there building the bonfire, and I think the idea is that people who are cold and hungry, who've been made cold and hungry because of the policies of our rulers, should warm themselves at some bonfire of manufactured outrage and then feast on contrived anxieties about enemies that our government has designated for their benefit. And that's what I think is going on here. You have this growing into really a full-scale cultural conflict between Christians and Muslims here in this country. There are not many Muslims in this country. Most of them who live here have been brought here as a result of our foreign policy.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is William Grigg. And before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website, how they can read your articles on the blog, how they can listen to your radio program, and how they can find your PayPal button there. And, of course, we hope that people will support William. He does a great job, and he really is dependent upon the generosity of people who believe in what he's doing, and I certainly believe in what he's doing. So you go right ahead. How can people find these items?
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate. It means for freedom, and the web address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or the listeners can go to Google or some other search engine and type in my name, William Grigg, and chances are Pro Libertate would be one of the first returns you'd get. If you type in Pro Libertate, that's P-R-O, and then L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, either that or my name or some combination of my name and Pro Libertate, that should be the first return that you would get. And I publish, I don't know, maybe three or four times a week, depending upon my schedule. My current essay is also being posted, cross-posted, at lewrockwell.com. That is the website maintained by Lew Rockwell, the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And I write a great deal for the blog at his website. And he, as well, republishes a lot of what I write there at lewrockwell.com. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate, Pro Libertate Radio. It's broadcast every Wednesday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time on the Liberty News Radio Network. LibertyNewsRadio.com is the homepage of Liberty News Radio. That network is located in Utah, and there are, I believe, several dozen, 50 or 60 affiliates of Liberty News Radio. It's been up and running for about a year, maybe a year and a half now. Listeners can find a roster of our local affiliates at libertynewsradio.com, or they can listen to the programs by way of live streaming on the Internet. They're available as podcasts, courtesy of iTunes. I believe now we're going to be streaming the program by way of a couple of different portable telephone handheld digital communication devices. I don't even call them a telephone anymore, but in any case, it's going to be available in a number of different formats. LibertyNewsRadio.com is the address to find all of that information about my radio show and also a number of other programs by a number of other guests. They're all archived there as well. And as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, at my blog, Pro Libertate, at the end of every essay, there is a PayPal button which people can use if they have the means and the interest in contributing to keep that website up and running and, quite frankly, to keep my family with a roof over our head and food in our refrigerator. This is how I am supporting my family right now, as well as whatever other odd jobs I can find, be they freelance editing or day laborer type work. That's what I do to support my family. This is something I do out of conviction, so I really do appreciate the fact that many people in your audience have been very generous to us. It's basically what has sustained us and supported us, along with your prayers, which we really do appreciate. Thanks so much for everything that you've done for us, Dr. Stan, and I'd like to thank your audience as well.
Well, you're more than welcome. Now, William was talking about this mosque that they want to build close to the 911 site and how terrible this is, and, oh, you know, this is an insult to the people who died there, and what they're doing is confusing the issue.
Yes.
The real question, of course, is, have we been told the truth about what happened that day? If certainly 19 hijackers, you know, were on those planes and they all died that day, how could it be that 6 or 7 of them are alive and well over in the Middle East? Now, you can check this out on the internet. Just type in 9/11 hijackers living and well in the Middle East, and you'll find out that they number of people have tracked these people down, these people who supposedly died that day, and they're alive. I don't understand that. I don't understand how actually two of the passports survived. Certainly the black boxes, most of the black boxes disappeared, but certainly two of the passports, one from one of the hijackers in the plane that hit the North Tower, and one of the passports of one of the hijackers who went down at Sharpsville, I guess it was, there in Pennsylvania. Anyway, of course, their passports survived. How could that possibly have happened? How could it possibly be that none of our fighter planes were available that morning? Certainly, ordinarily, if a plane is hijacked, immediately fighter planes in the air, unless there's a stand down order. And of course, we've been told there was a stand down order by a gentleman we interviewed, Sergeant Lauro Chavez, who mysteriously disappeared right after we interviewed him, never to be heard from again. And he may be alive and well someplace, just not doing any more radio programs. But I was never able to interview him, and you can read the articles about him up on the website, saying what a terrible individual he was and how he said he was at CENTCOM headquarters that morning. But they've checked at CENTCOM headquarters, and there's no evidence he was ever there. And I would simply ask the members of the listening audience, how many of you think that you could actually call CENTCOM headquarters in Florida and ask if Sergeant Laura Chavez was at headquarters on the morning of September 11th, 2001? Ladies and gentlemen, these are simply planted articles to discredit a man who has come forward and said there was a stand-down order on September 11th, and it was given by Dick Cheney. And Laura Chavez, the gentleman, we have my interview with him, he disappeared right after that. So basically, there are a lot of people who really don't believe we've been told the truth. They think that some branch of government, some intelligence agency, or some wicked group took those down, and we've been lied to about what happened that morning. But now they focus our attention on the mosque. And of course, by getting involved in this issue, why we're missing the really big question is, what really happened on the morning of September 11th? And why did they tell us 6,000 people died when only a little less than 3,000 died? And why were they telling the people at the South Tower to stay at their desks that morning, order them to stay at their desks, do not leave, the North Tower is in flames, but do not get up and do not leave? And fortunately, the fellow in charge, Morgan Stanley, got the people out and saved their lives, almost 2,500 of them, or they would have perished too. And nobody's ever asked, who gave those orders over the loudspeaker, and why did they give it? You would think they would have wanted to get the people out of the South Tower. Well, go right ahead.
Well, one of the things that people don't understand in the larger context of what happened on 9/11 is what happened in 1993 with the first attempt to bomb the World Trade Center, which came to relatively little. I mean, I believe there are a half dozen people that were killed. There were several dozen who were injured. But had Mohammed Soleimani not been the most stupid and inept terrorist in human memory, if he had parked his Ryder truck against the correct support strut in the tower where he had secreted it, the design was that that tower would have collapsed and taken out the other domino fashion, and the result would have been several tens of thousands of casualties. And this was something that the FBI had been aware of. They had detailed advanced warning of the plot in 1993 to bomb the World Trade Center. Imad Salem, who was a former Egyptian army officer, had infiltrated that little knot of conspirators, almost all of whom had some connection to the United States military and or United States intelligence, including Ali Mohammed, who was the former Special Forces captain, who was a privileged asset of the FBI, and he's the guy who called the shots in that conspiracy. Yeah, Omar, Sheikh Omar, the so-called blind sheikh, who was brought into this country as the spiritual leader of this conspiracy. He was issued a visa by the CIA section chief in Khartoum, Sudan.
Despite the fact he was a known terrorist. That was
he was on the State Department watch list. You had, Mahmoud Abu Alima, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, had been part of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. He was a member of that notorious Al-Quds Mosque in Munich, Germany, rather. He's somebody who had been networking with people in the domestic radical Muslim elements in Brooklyn for years. He had a number of people who were involved in the Al-Khalifa fundraising center in Brooklyn. All these people were very well known to U.S. authorities. Many of them had been involved in the plot in 1990 to murder Rabbi Meir Kahane. And when Meir Kahane was gunned down by El-Said Nosair, who was part of that conspiracy, a search of his apartment revealed detailed and voluminous information about that plot. So Imad Salem infiltrated that group. He was told by his FBI handler that they were going to render the bomb inert. The FBI didn't do so, and Imad Salem, after the fact, after the bombing had took place, managed to get his FBI handler on tape admitting that the FBI had known about what was going to happen in January of 1993. And so you have a vivid and undeniable precedent here for detailed advanced knowledge by the FBI and by other intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies, the federal government, with respect to the first World Trade Center bombing. Given everything we know about detailed advanced knowledge of what happened on 2001, the very least that we can say responsibly is that the federal government had guilty foreknowledge of that event and was guilty of grotesque negligence, at the very least, and it gets worse from there. So like you said, Dr. Stan, this whole contrived controversy about the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which A, is not going to be a Ground Zero, and B, isn't a mosque, and C, is a community center that had been planned no later than 1999, had nothing to do with 2001, that's a huge distraction from the culpability of the federal government of some sort or another for what happened on September 11, 2001. But it gets even worse from there when you put this in the context of this obvious effort to try to rile the public up for some kind of ripping good conflict with the Muslim world in general, which is a horrible idea. First of all, as a Christian, I have to say that my preference would be that Muslims become believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. And this is not something that we're going to do by bombing helpless Muslim populations in Pakistan or Sudan or Somalia or Afghanistan or Iraq or elsewhere. Just thinking in terms of what the Great Commission really teaches, we're supposed to make disciples of all nations. We're not supposed to make corpses out of non-believers. That's not our role as Christians. Looking at it from the perspective of statesmanship, statecraft here, it is a perfectly ridiculous idea to be out cultivating enemies while we need not have them. That, of course, is not something compatible with our Republican, small-r Republican traditions, with our Constitution here in terms of what it authorized the government to do, with the wisdom of men such as Washington and Jefferson, who urged that we defend the rights of Americans, that we cultivate good relations with all nations, that we have entangling alliances with none of them. And this is where we get into trouble here, is that the government ruling us has been deeply entangled and has been actively cultivating the worst elements within the Muslim world. In my current essay about this subject, I point out something that I think is completely forgotten by people who are allowing themselves to be caught in this manufactured furor over the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, and that is the following. The most powerful patron of radical Islam in history is the United States government. It isn't Saudi Arabia, it isn't Iran, it isn't Iraq, it isn't any of the Emirates, it's not Turkey, it's the United States government. It has been that way for decades, and it's that way today. And that includes the long-term, deeply perverted relationship between the CIA and the so-called Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, as I point out in this article, I won't get into the specifics right now because this is something we discussed before, and I know that you saw Mr. Dreyfus's book, Devil's Game, which goes into detail about this, as well as the new book, A Mosque in Munich, talks about this in some depth as well. But the Muslim Brotherhood basically was a creation of people who were deeply involved in the tenebrous underworld of intelligence agency and secret society intrigue in the 19th century, the great-great-grandfather of the Muslim Brotherhood was a non-believer. He was somebody who called himself al-Afghani because in Afghanistan he was an agent first of Russian intelligence, and then he switched sides and became an agent of British intelligence. He was involved in Freemasonry, deeply involved in organizing through his Masonic connections an underworld of intelligence assets and terrorists for hire, thugs for hire, to serve the interests of British imperial politics. And he was the guy who sort of set the template for what became the Muslim Brotherhood, and was organized in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna. Now, Mr. al-Banna was assassinated in 1949. His son-in-law, a fellow by the name of Saeed Ramadan, was brought to the White House in 1953 as part of a delegation from the Muslim world. I've got a photograph on my blog of him meeting with Dwight Eisenhower in the Oval Office. Mr. Ramadan was the chief organizer for the Muslim Brotherhood. More importantly, he was the organizer of those elements within the Muslim Brotherhood that were inclined toward radical and subversive activities, not only in the Muslim world, but in the West. And there's a direct line, a patriarchal line of descent, if you will, from the Muslim Brotherhood to groups such as Hamas, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, organized with the help of Israeli intelligence, the CIA, in 1987, and even that shadowy and badly overrated club that we call Al-Qaeda today, they're all groups that emerged out of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, with respect to this furor over the Ground Zero Mosque, we're told that Imam Raouf, the fellow who's the head of the Cordova Institute, has connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. That may or may not be true. It's difficult to find anybody in the Muslim world right now who's not in some sense connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, because it's almost a ubiquitous organization. And that reflects the fact that its patron for the last 60 years has been the United States government, which has a lot of money to throw around. But if he does have connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, they're much less important than those which exist between Washington and the Muslim Brotherhood, between the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood. And you've got in Washington the government which during the last 7 years since the invasion of Iraq began in 2003, has done more than any other Muslim power in recent memory to expand the scope of Sharia law. And it did this by invading Iraq and overthrowing a loathsome but relatively secular government, one of the few in the region, and installing at the point of American bayonets a constitution that formally and explicitly established Sharia law in that country. And as a result, you have this huge forced exodus of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Christians, many of whom were members of religious congregations that traced their roots back to the days of the early disciples and spoke the language, the Aramaic language that was spoken by our Lord during his mortal ministry. These people have been scattered to places like Jordan and Syria and Detroit and elsewhere because the United States government promoted Sharia law at gunpoint, at bayonet point in Iraq. And so the case against the Ground Zero so-called mosque, and in a larger sense, what we're hearing now is the idea that we should have no mosques at all anywhere in the United States. That case resides on the assumption that mosques are focal points for radicalizing Muslims and recruiting soldiers for jihad.
And I think even more that the Muslim, these radical Islamists were responsible for what happened on the morning of September 11th. The real question is, what did happen there? Why won't we have an independent investigation? Why won't Congress investigate it? And I'll tell you why not. They're afraid to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's no constituency for it because it would reflect badly on, first of all, the entire political system, and then it would implicate the power elite. The power elite, of course, runs things. They're not going to allow themselves to be exposed in any way that would lead to their accountability.
And I think basically what you have to understand is they get us arguing on the wrong issue.
Yeah.
They're masters at this. They're masters of deceit. And so we debate back and forth, should we have a mosque? Shouldn't we have a mosque? Should we have mosques in America? Should we not have mosques in America? Why should we give them religious freedom when they don't give us religious freedom, or Christians religious freedom in their countries? And once again, we're arguing the wrong issues. It's amazing how they can manipulate the American people. Our guest, William Grigg, will be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. William, got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight.
Dr. Stan, once again, it's been a a privilege and a delight to be with you this evening. Thanks again for the opportunity and the like.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.